Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, February 18, 2020. Another aid worker is killed in South Sudan.
Ultimately, two of the four aid workers were captured by the youth, and one was shot and killed. He was a South Sudanese.
And the destructive desert locusts have reached South Sudan.
Our team and those of FAO, we send people there, and they confirm the presence of locusts in Mukwi County in the area of Lobbono.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A top United Nations official in South Sudan is condemning the killing of an aid worker in Pibor County last week. UN Humanitarian Coordinator for South Sudan, Matthew Hollingsworth, says the government should protect all humanitarians working in the country. Lasuba Memo reports for VOA from Juba.
Hollingsworth said in his statement that last Wednesday, a clearly marked humanitarian vehicle belonging to an international non-organization was stopped along the Pibor-Gumuruk road at a roadblock manned by unknown armed youth. Steve O'Malley, UN OCHA's head of office in Juba, who read Hollingsworth's statement to this program, says two aid workers were captured.
Ultimately, two of the four aid workers, were captured by the youth, and one was shot and killed. He was a South Sudanese national. Now the other three did survive.
The second captured aid worker was released. Hollingsworth says in the statement, another aid worker who survived the attack is receiving ongoing support services. The motive of the killing is unclear. Quoting Hollingsworth again, O'Malley says OCHA condemns the incident and is calling for all those responsible to be held to account.
I call upon the government, all parties and communities to step up efforts to protect humanitarians who are working tirelessly to provide much-needed assistance and improve the lives of people living in isolated areas.
At least 116 aid workers have been killed since the start of the conflict in December 2013, most of them being South Sudanese nationals, according to OCHA. Hollingsworth says OCHA sends its deepest condolences to the family of the named victim and the affected organization. Pibor County has a huge presence of aid workers deployed in the area following last year's heavy flash floods, coupled with severe humanitarian needs over the past few years. For VOA News, I am Lasuba Memo in Juba.
South Sudanese authorities say desert locusts that have been ravaging parts of neighboring Uganda and Kenya have reached South Sudan. The government says it is trying to raise more than 2.5 billion South Sudanese pounds to battle the insects. Viola Elias reports for VOA from Juba.
Onyoti Adigo, South Sudan's Food and Agriculture Minister, confirmed to reporters in Juba a few hours ago that a mature swamp of locusts entered South Sudan on Monday.
Yesterday, we received a report that the desert locust has entered South Sudan from Mugwe County, and we thought that it was the normal green grasshopper, like it has been reported earlier. But our team and those of FAO, we send people there, and they confirm the presence of locusts in Mukwi County, in the area of Lobbono, and Awignibul and Panekwar.
The locusts cross into southeast area of Magwi County from northern Uganda, Lawom district. Meshak Malo, the country representative for the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, says his agency is working with South Sudan Agriculture Ministry to launch a plan to prevent the spread of the locusts before they lay egg.
The population of about 2,000 that arrived are this mature. That means that the area around there, because of the sandy nature, is a good environment for them to be able to lay eggs. When we are going to weigh our control measures, in which we have discussed at large this morning with the ministry, is that at this stage, what is the best treatment moving forward.
One option, says Malo, is to freeze them in the area the locusts lay eggs. He says when they get to Hooper stage, the government will come up with another line of attack. James Janga, South Sudan Minister for Livestock and Fisheries, says the arrival of locusts will adversely affect many South Sudanese communities, especially crop production.
At the present moment, we are also afraid of the livestock because they will invade the grazing areas, and will deprive the livestock of the grass, knowing very well that we graze our livestock free range in our open areas and swamps. So this we now see as a big economic issue.
Janka says desert locusts are not a nationwide issue at the moment, but a regional issue that requires collective action to prevent the locusts from spreading any further. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
Still on locusts, the locust desert spread across East Africa. Uganda has deployed its army to battle all-consuming insects. The pests are laying countless eggs that are expected to hatch within weeks, raising concerns among farmers that the worst is yet to come. Alima Atumani reports from Uthuke District in northeast Uganda.
Uganda is the latest East African country battling an invasion of millions of desert locusts after the pest this month crossed the Kenya border. Thomas Onyango, a farmer in Oringo Liech village, woke one morning to find his garden being consumed.
Half of the garden, there are no leaves on the cassava. When you check on the pigeon peas, all the leaves are gone. Even the fruits that I was expecting to harvest now, they are all down on the ground.
Authorities say about 20 districts in northeast Uganda so far are affected. To fight back, Uganda deployed 2,000 troops armed with pesticide. But Major General Sam Kavuma, the spraying coordinator for the Uganda People's Defense Force, says the locusts are skilled in evading their counterattacks.
One challenge which is being solved, that is aerial support to spray them, you know, from air, because for us we deal much with those which are on the ground. And when we kill them or during the spray, then they jump and go on top of the trees where our pumps cannot reach.
Ugandan authorities say they are working to secure helicopters for aerial spraying. Meanwhile, the army is stretched as it chases the constantly moving swarms. Locals are left to their own devices to try to scare away the bugs, mostly by banging on pots and making noise. Sarah Akelo, a resident of Otuke, was one who gave the pests a chase.
For me, I'm fearing them. That locals, they are eating grass where my animals, goat, cows, and others.
Locust experts say if the swarms are not stopped, the eggs they are laying now will hatch within 2 weeks and the invading numbers will skyrocket. John Vahana is a locust expert with the Uganda Ministry of Agriculture.
What it means is that if eggs are laid and successfully hatch, then we are going into another generation, and that generation will have multiplied up to 4 or 5 times the original population. So it's a huge increase. It's an increase that can be frightening.
Experts say warm weather and heavy rains around the Red Sea coast triggered massive locust breeding in Djibouti, Eritrea and Sudan. The pests have been devouring crops in Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, Tanzania and Uganda in the worst swarms seen in decades. If not brought under control, authorities said the desert locusts could soon threaten food security across the region. Halima Athmani for VA News, Otuke, Uganda.
From Uganda, we move to Kenya, where the government has launched an operation to flush out Al-Shabaab terrorists from the northeast Boni Forest on the border with Somalia. The operation was meant to last a few months, But nearly 5 years later, security forces are still struggling to stamp out the Islamist militants. Villagers are afraid to venture into the forest, and a deadly January attack on a joint Kenya-US military base has highlighted ongoing insecurity. Muhammad Yusuf reports for VOA from Kainangwe, Kenya.
20-year-old Bilai Abdi said she was excited about getting her two children new clothes one afternoon in 2017. She and six other civilians got into a police vehicle to get to the next town. They never reached their destination. As a car hit a roadside bomb and was then attacked with gunfire, killing all the civilians except Abdi. The mother of four dragged herself out of the bullet-ridden car. My leg was bleeding and one man aimed at me, she says. She also says she tried to duck but the bullet hit her in the neck. The man came down and passed by me, thinking I was dead, without even looking at me, she says. A few hours later, police helicopter was hovering above her head. Abdi says she saw security moving around her but couldn't see clearly. She says an officer recognized her, but another pointed his gun at her and called her Al-Shabaab. Abdi says she replied that she was not Al-Shabaab. What Al-Shabaab person has a child, she asked. Abdi says they walked away and soon she was put in the helicopter. Abdi survived, but it took until January of this year for surgeries to remove the bullets lodged in her neck and left leg. Kenyan authorities have since banned civilians from travelling with security, says Lamu County Commissioner Irungu Masharia.
The terror groups mainly target our security vehicles and security officers. So by having civilians on those vehicles, you know, they also become targets.
Kenya launched an operation to flush out Al-Shabaab terrorists from the Boni Forest on the border with Somalia in 2015. It was to last only a few months, but nearly 5 years later, villagers still avoid going too far into the forest for fear of attack, according to local resident Abala Waro. If you are seen in the forest, you can be killed, he says. You don't know these people. They are animals who live in the forest. You are nothing to them. It is better I die here of my hunger than go deep into the forest. Somalia-based Al-Shabaab has been attacking and fighting Kenyan troops since 2011, when the government sent soldiers into Somalia to combat the militant group. Underscoring the insecurity along the border, the militants launched a brazen assault on joint Kenya-US military base in Lamu County, Kenya in January. Three Americans were killed. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Kiangwe, Kenya.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, addressing the needs of young Africans and their sexual health. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what makes a relationship strong?
The only thing is trusting one another. When you trust someone, you will not think negative of your partner.
Communication. The moment you communicate, everything is going to be sorted. Because most marriages always break out because of little communication among the spouses.
Trust and faith. When, for example, if I'm in a relationship, I would suggest, it's important for your partner to trust you and have faith in you.
Relationship can be strong when you understand yourself, you have unity and you work together, and you also have common activities you do together so that you can share the relationship. The relationship will be stronger.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America, and it's time for our Tuesday Health segment. And today we are talking about funding for sexual health on the African continent. Young people from across Africa are urging their governments to direct resources to addressing social needs, especially those affecting women and girls. From the Kenyan capital, Ruben Chama reports on a recent conference on helping women and girls in formal settlements.
The UN Population Agency, UNFPA, says more than 200 million women and girls around the world want to delay or prevent pregnancy but do not have the means. Many are from indigenous, rural, and marginalized communities or living with disabilities, and they face the greatest gaps in services. Participants at the recent 9th African Conference on Sexual Health and Rights urged African governments to seek solutions to the inequalities facing women and girls in informal settlements across the continent. Gladys Kiyo is a program manager at African Gender and Media Initiative Trust, a non-profit organization that works to advance gender equality through research and action on women's human rights.
To me, sexual reproductive health and rights means being able to access information on reproductive health, the various methods, all options, being able to access the service such that I'm able to know the range of family planning options that I have, information about menstrual health management hygiene, about sexually transmitted infections, including HIV and AIDS, and that when I visit the health facility, I should be able to access that without discrimination.
Activists say slum dwellers particularly are more likely to have poor healthcare services, unmet needs for contraception and unsafe abortions. They also are at greater risk of sexual and gender-based violence. These risks mean girls in slums are more likely to leave school early, perpetuating a vicious cycle of poverty. Nancy Auma is a 20-year-old woman from a Ashanti neighborhood in Kibera slum in Nairobi.
There are a number of issues affecting the women and girls in Kibera. Like, for instance, the young girls, they lack sanitary towels for their period. So when the time comes when they are supposed to have their menses, they struggle a lot and they miss school. There's 50 primary schools. In those schools, we go and empower them. We talk to them about their menstrual health. We talk to them about how they can keep neat and also how they cannot miss school just by being female.
Dr. Uemedimo Esiet from Nigeria convened the conference on advancing sexual and reproductive rights for women and girls in slum areas. He says African countries need to invest more in healthcare services, especially for women and girls.
We have neglected for too long the plight of women and girls living in our urban informal settlements. And if we don't do something, the numbers are staggering. In fact, there is a 2012 World Prospects report that showed that the population of people living in urban informal settlements was almost 1 billion. And we know that most of these persons are residing in Africa.
Hundreds of delegates, including government officials, policy experts, and representatives of civil society organizations, took part in the deliberations. Neo Marumo from South Africa was among the young women at the conference.
Myself as a black African young woman, I believe that sexuality, it's about me. It's not about my province. It's not about my pastor. It's not about my president. It's about me. It's about self. It's about me. So I should decide for myself. I should set the rules because it's my body. It's my choice.
Organizers said recommendations from the conference will be presented for consideration by the African Union policy organs. Participants said they would also engage national governments on the issue. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
And now for some U.S. politics. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is wrapping up his three-nation trip to Africa, with his latest stop being Ethiopia, where he expressed his support for African countries, including their efforts to fight coronavirus. VOA's Sinti Sain has more from Addis Ababa.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has had a packed day here in Ethiopia, in Addis Ababa, meeting with the foreign minister, the president, the prime minister, and going to the U.S. embassy and meeting with an interreligious council there. So it's been a packed day. In his meeting with the Ethiopian president, Secretary Pompeo commended her work and her leadership in advancing landmark reforms and her efforts to support women's empowerment initiatives. And later on in the press availability, he said that it was just remarkable that Ethiopia has a woman president. In his meeting with Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, the secretary said that they discussed the importance of organizing free and fair elections to be held in August later this year. And he thanked the prime minister for his leadership in the Horn of Africa and for Ethiopia's peacekeeping deployments to Somalia, Sudan, and South Sudan. At a joint press availability with Ethiopia's foreign minister, I had the opportunity to ask the foreign minister and Secretary Pompeo, and I asked the foreign minister what was the greatest accomplishment these last 2 years, and what was the biggest concern. He was very candid and said that they had made remarkable progress towards reform, but that youth unemployment was his biggest worry. Secretary Pompeo said that for him, the greatest thing about the reform in Ethiopia is that it's coming from Ethiopia itself, and the role of the U.S. was not to impose anything, but simply to support the efforts that are ongoing. The next stop on the trip will be Saudi Arabia and then Oman. Pleasure talking to you. This is Cindy Sain with VOA News in Addis Ababa.
The UN-sponsored military talks between Libya's warring factions resumed today in Geneva. The military representatives of the Government of National Accord say they will demand the withdrawal of Libyan National Army, led by General Khalifa Haftar, from neighborhoods south of the capital as their first condition for continuing talks. Haftar said no ceasefire until the end of what he called military rule in Tripoli. EU foreign ministers agreed yesterday to a naval operation to enforce an arms embargo on Libya, hoping to contribute to a permanent ceasefire. VOA's senior analyst Mohammed Al-Ashenawi spoke with security analysts at the National Council on U.S.-Libya Relations about the possibilities of reaching a permanent ceasefire in Libya.
Unfortunately, such a compromise is quite unlikely. On the battlefield, the GNA is currently in a much better position. Turkish reinforcements, in particular air defense missiles, precision artillery, and about 6,000 Syrian mercenaries and Islamists, give the GNA the upper edge on the battlefield. They want to exploit this, understandably. They want to force the LNA away from Tripoli, but not only away from Tripoli, they also want to get access to the oil fields, either by negotiations, unlikely that Haftar will agree, or by military means. If Haftar would accept to withdraw from Tripoli and to give up the oil fields later on, the LNA would certainly break up. And the LNA furthermore believes that they can defend the current position until the GNA runs out of funds. You are aware that the oil terminals and the oil fields are currently blocked by tribes loyal to General Haftar.
European Union foreign ministers agreed Monday to a naval operation to enforce an arms embargo on war-torn Libya and intervene to stop arms shipments. Could that contribute to reaching a permanent ceasefire in Libya?
These plans of the European Union are quite interesting, but not really new. They intend to establish surveillance from air, from space, and the maritime surveillance, as you've indicated, to enforce the arms embargo, as it is already mandated by the UN. The main deliveries to the warring factions are from Turkey to the GNA and from the UAE to the Libyan National Army. Both sides, the embargo would need a quite different embargo enforcement. With regard to the GNA, this is not about smaller vessels or fishing boats. This is about huge roll-on, roll-off ships and container vessels, in part escorted by the Turkish Navy. They are transporting tanks, artillery, and so on and so on. Civilian and military transport aircraft from Turkey land in Misrata almost every night. Although technically possible to stop these ships and to intercept these aircraft, to be honest, I doubt that the EU is really willing to stop and search Turkish ships and stop and intercept Turkish aircraft over the Mediterranean. It's a different story with regard to the UAE. They are flying in with aircraft also almost every night through the Egyptian airspace. So this means that the EU would need to maintain combat air patrols over the Sahara Desert from a base as far away as Crete, 1,000 kilometers. This is, from a military point, extremely difficult. I doubt that this is really doable. Or in Egypt, I doubt that al-Sisi would agree to this. So from a military point of view, this would be extremely challenging to enforce. Enforcing the arms embargo was already the mission of the forerunner Operation Sophia. They did not intercept a single ship. And I would say this was mainly because there was no real political will to enforce the embargo. We'll see if this is different now.
World leaders agreed at Berlin summit last month to end all meddling in the Libyan conflict and stop the flow of weapons to Libya. But little has changed on the ground since then. What else should the international community do to stabilize Libya?
Different sides and the others, the Europeans, need to ask themselves what is acceptable for them. Is it acceptable for the supporters of the GNA, for Turkey and for Qatar, that almost all the oil fields are under control of the Libyan National Army? On the other side, is it acceptable for those who back the Libyan National Army, Egypt, UAE and the others, to have political Islamists in charge in Tripoli? And now, in particular significance for Europe, how can they deal with a situation where Turkey de facto controls also migration over the central Mediterranean, so not only in the eastern Mediterranean, but also in the central Mediterranean? And how can they deal with the flow of gas from Libya to Europe is controlled by Turkey? If the different sides are clear about the point, if they are clear about the stance, I think it would be necessary to move on from the failed Libya political agreement, from the so-called Shkirat agreement, and it would be necessary to find an entirely new approach, an entirely new framework for the stabilization of Libya. And here, I would say, a federalist approach, as outlined in Libya's old constitution, could help.
That was VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Ashanawi speaking with Wolfgang Putzai, security analyst at the National Council on U.S.-Libya Relations. That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with Freedom Voice. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for tuning in this evening. Tune in again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
koja kore na muru kongu. Joseph lagu koja kore na rosoka kika kana tindikare.